In this podcast episode, we're going to look at using self-managed superannuation for property investing. It is a little bit of a minefield, and sometimes people just don't go near it because it seems so overwhelming and expensive and just like it's all in a foreign language. So we've got a member of our own property lovers community joining us today, Andrew Cochran, to talk us through the world of property investing using superannuation. Let's have a listen. Hi, Andrew. So glad you could make it. And thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today. Let's kick off. Perhaps you could explain to us how and why we'd use superannuation for investing in property. So a high level overview and maybe cover off some of the risks and the limitations.
Documentation. I'm really anal about making sure the paperwork's right. And a lot of times things are set up and they're just not set up correctly, and it causes problems down the track. So I wouldn't say it's a limitation, but it's an essential, you know, in the sense of getting anything set up. Holding property in super, you'd normally have a couple hundred thousand dollars to roll over. It's not a hard and fast rule, but it is conventional thinking that about 200 is about what you'd do to start a super fund, self-managed super fund. And that obviously can mean husband and wife, spouses combining, which is gives people a greater opportunity, I think, to actually set a fund up if they're in their, say, late 30s, early 40s. What else have I said here? Liquidity buffer is another area that's important, especially when you're considering property investment. Normally, the lenders require a liquidity buffer of 10% or better for things like property running expenses and any fees and so forth related to the super fund and interest costs, etc. The other thing that's important is that some people forget sometimes is that all costs related to the super fund and its investments must be paid from the fund. You sometimes get people paying a rates notice for their property from their personal account. It must be paid from the super fund. And there are ways of overcoming that issue if there's a shortage of money by making an extra contribution. Expenses and any income can't be paid from personal accounts or in your account. The people will say, well, look, it's your money, but not just yet. Tax and compliance must be done in a timely manner. And the tax office can actually freeze the fund to new contributions and rollovers if the tax return is late, for example, or any other things like the ASIC requirements for a trustee. All of those things have to be done in a timely manner. If they're not, then the fund can be frozen. And then if you've got contributions going from your employer, then they get rejected. So it's really important to make sure everything's done in a timely manner. Exceeding contribution limits, the contribution limits are pretty strict in the levels that you can go to. So we don't want to be exceeding those. Otherwise, there's substantial penalties. The other very important area is you must have a written investment strategy and personal life disability income replacement plans, which is basically an offshoot of the investment strategy. It's got to be a consideration if it's done properly, and they need to reflect what the super fund invests in and appropriate levels of insurance cover for members. So all that sort of thing I'd obviously get heavily involved in.
Yeah, look, sounds like a lot to go through there. How do you get started if you're a total newbie but you want to invest your super in property?
A lot of people get a bit taken aback by the self-managed super fund. I suppose they feel that there's a lot of paperwork and it's too hard and all this sort of thing, but it's actually not. It's not that bad. It's just a matter of having a proper administrator, a professional administrator. I usually use, there's a couple of administrators I use, but they do all of the tax compliance and all of the record keeping, and you've got an online access facility so that you can have a look at your account and see what investments are held and so forth. So that's really important. But it's really just getting, just speaking to someone who knows what they're doing in that area. And obviously that's part of what I do. So it's finding out how much they've got in, if it's a husband and wife or a spouse situation, where what's the combined super amount, what are they looking to do? There's obviously a lot of people want to take more control of their superannuation these days because of transparency. Transparency is the big issue. And I always go on about industry super funds, for example, which are just big pooled slush funds almost, I call them. And there is absolutely no transparency on where your money's invested. So, and this is why I think self-managed super has become even more popular than ever these days, even with younger people, because they want to take control of where their money's invested.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about these kind of off the plan, or sometimes they'll, you know, they'll buddy up with a developer or something. And is there anything to be aware of, or traps?
You mean establishing a self-managed fund with a, say, a developer? Because I know people promote, obviously there's a lot of promoters around. Usually what happens is I mentioned before, documentation, documentation, documentation. It's a bit like location, location, location with a self-managed super fund. You have to, invariably what happens is there's obviously a decent cost in setting these things up, especially if you've got borrowings in the fund, if you're buying a property. So it's so important to have everything signed off correctly, dated, all those sorts of things, and recorded properly. Quite often I see the trust documents are just not signed off properly, directors' minutes, all those sorts of things, you know, investment strategy. They might have the document, but they haven't signed it off, and it hasn't been done at the right time and all those sort of things. So you really need to go to an impartial advisor if you're going to be thinking about this, rather than someone who's saying, look, you know, we've got this investment property, we'll help you set up a self-managed fund. And but then that's about all they do. And you might do it on the cheap, but in the end, it's going to cost you.
Yep, get it, and seen it before. So, Andrew, what about if you are wanting to do it and you're serious about it and you get your ducks in a row, how do you find the lender and the right property, and what are the rules around that sort of thing and the limitations?
As you probably know, the lending in a self-managed super fund is a fair bit different to traditional lending because there's extra requirements. Finding the property, I mean, it can obviously be through the elite mentoring group where you can do your property searches and so forth and do your own research and that sort of thing. Obviously there are a number of promoters and so forth, which, and a number of them are pretty good at promoting particular property, whether it be, you know, the big thing at the moment is NDIS. A lot of people are interested in that, but the price to entry is pretty prohibitive because of the construction costs and all those sort of things. So it's about really just, even if you do the traditional way of things where you go to a real estate agents and you get to talk to them about what's available with property in your area or whatever sort of property you're looking at. Commercial property is very popular in self-managed funds because the business owners can actually own the property and pay rent to themselves effectively through their super. So they'd be paying rent anyway if they had commercial premises. With residential, it's a bit more restrictive. You cannot let the property to a related party, family member, all those sorts of things, even if it's done through a real estate agent. It's just against the rules to do that. So you have to have it in a traditional rental property arrangement normally through a real estate agent managing the tenants and so forth. And you can do it that way. The big advantages are leveraging into the property, which you can't really do with conventional super. And by leveraging, I mean obviously using other people's money to build your asset base. And if you do that, the end retirement benefit should be quite a bit more than what it would be, again, under conventional superannuation funds, which, you know, are readily available in the public.
Okay, and are there any limitations on the types of properties you can buy?
No, residential, not really, not really. It's more about the buffer that you'll need. You mentioned before about lenders. One of the things they do say is they want a cash buffer or a liquidity buffer, which could be shares and cash investments in the fund, and that's normally going to be 10%. I sort of try to lean towards a little bit higher than that if you can, because the advantage of that is that you can build that liquidity buffer over time and then use that money down the track to pay debt down more quickly if you want to do that. But as I say, it's subject to contribution limits and so forth as far as how much more you want to put in if you want to again reduce debt levels and so forth. So it's really but as far as property goes, there's not a great deal of restriction on property in the sense that as long as it's a commercial transaction, not related party, and although commercial property, there's a slight acceptance for that. But apart from that, it's really to do with a normal commercial arrangement, let through to unrelated parties and so forth. So you've got a fair bit of scope there, as far as property goes.
Okay, and can you do anything to it? Like, can you renovate or develop?
Developments, it's the subject to quite a few rules there. Renovating is an improvement or a renovation is a no-no. But you can obviously repair things. So if something's broken or for example, a fire went through one of the rooms or something like that, you'd be able to get that repaired. But renovations are an improvement, so that's not part of the rules that allow you to do that.
And can you sell the property if you want to? Do you have to hold it for a certain period or any limitations there?
No, you can sell at any time. You have capital gains tax issues and so forth. Capital gains tax and super fund is only 10%, so it's actually pretty small. The big advantage for any property, commercial, is one that, as I say, I sort of go back to because a lot of people hold the property for quite a long time. Residential, commercial, doesn't really matter. And if you're, let's say you're in your 40s and you sell it in 20 years' time, and you're in what they call income stream phase or pension phase in the super fund, that is subject to the new legislative requirements on the $3 million account balance. You can sell the asset because it's a big lumpy asset. Any capital gains would be zero in income stream or pension phase. So the only restriction there, or the only caveat I'd put on that is that if it's at more than $3 million, which is this new legislative introduction by the Labor government, which hasn't, I don't think it's gone through yet, but it probably will.
So, can you tell us about any changes in laws or new regulations that have come in around superannuation investing and property?
It's probably more to do with the $3 million cap on, and you've got there's two caps actually. There's I think the latest cap is about 1.8 million for an individual account, where if you're in pension phase, the first 1.8 can be in pension phase. Anything above that is in what they call accumulation phase, which is what we do when we're working, and that is subject to 15% tax on earnings. But with the 3 million cap, they're talking about 30% on the tax on earnings at that level. And the big issue there is unrealized capital gains they're talking about, which I don't know how they're going to do that, because you could have a situation where a property goes up by, I don't know, $200,000 in a year if it's a sizable value, and you're talking maybe $60,000 in tax to pay on an unrealized gain. I just don't understand how that's going to work. It's all very well in theory. So they're the main changes in recent times. So it's really, as I say, it's really about caps, tax rates on those up when you get above those cap rates. So you're not entirely into the tax-free pension phase. I think there's a fund which has about $300 million in it in Australia. I think it's the biggest self-managed super fund. So obviously they would be impacted, but at the moment they're in pension phase, which I think they are. That's 100% tax-free investment.
Wow, okay. So there can be some advantages. If we were considering rolling over into self-managed super and investing in property, is there a line in the sand where it's not worth it? And is there a point at which you consider it?
Yeah, well, it sort of comes back to what you're trying to achieve. But if you're going to acquire a property and borrow, the setup costs are about 5,000. That includes the self-managed fund, all the paperwork, and the custodial or bear trust, which will own the asset, and that protects the rest of the super fund from. The situation is if the asset had to be sold and the lender was repaid, they can't come back at you the rest of your super money, which is a good protection to have. But I mentioned before about the $200,000 figure. I've set up funds for less than that in the past because I know the contributions are at high levels. So, for example, you can have someone with $130,000 in there, but they're putting in $20,000 a year, and it might be more if it's a combined spouse situation. So you know they're going to get to 200,000 pretty quickly. And then it's a matter of saying, okay, what property asset can you acquire, which leaves us with that buffer, that 10% buffer we're trying to achieve. And so the lender is satisfied that that will be acceptable.
Now, a lot of people go to their accountants for this sort of advice, but you have to have someone licensed. Do financial advisors work with accountants, or how do you get your dream team together?
Yeah, the answer is yes. I've got a panel of accountants I deal with, but I use a professional administrator for the self-managed super fund. And the main reasons are, well, the first thing is they do all the during the year administration, so things like investment changes and so forth. And with a property, for example, I work fairly closely with them because I get a lot of the information myself, and then I can pass that on to them. With things like shares and managed funds and so forth, they can get access to view those details, so they're doing it in order. So the person has an online portal where they can look at their own superannuation fund, very much like what they do with traditional super funds. And whereas if you're doing it with an accountant, they tend to do it once a year. So, and you're paying about the same fee. You're paying about $2,500 a year. So, the accountants do a good job in the tax return and the financial statements, but they basically don't do anything during the year. The administrator does stuff during the year as well. So, for about the same price, you're getting a better service.
Okay, awesome. And Andrew, if we wanted to start using our super to invest in property, what's at grassroots level, what's the best way to get started?
I think you've got to speak to a licensed person on the advice side, because licensed advisors can advise on self-managed super. I imagine there are other people around that will purport to give advice in that area, but they're not licensed. So you've got to check that the person's licensed and get a bit of a background to their experience and so forth. The Financial Services Guide is a good indicator. And any licensed person would have one of those, which will normally it'll go through the licensed provider, and then usually a bit of a rundown on the person's experience and qualifications, so you're dealing with someone who can actually advise you in that area.
Okay, fantastic. So they can set it all up and then we can choose our own properties wherever we want and just run it by them.
That is certainly not. As a licensed advisor, I don't advise on direct property. When I say that, I don't say, "Well, go and buy number 42 Chapel Street, blah blah blah." I can't do that. What I do is I look at I can do all the cash flow numbers and all that sort of stuff, and say, "Okay, well, if you buy a property for X, assuming growth rates and so forth, I can show them the end result down the track, and the fact that there's as I mentioned before, if you sell the asset in the income stream phase, subject to those caps I was talking about, you'll pay no tax on the capital gain." So it's really about you can choose the property you want. You can choose your commercial premises. If you're running a business and it has an office, or it's a factory or something like that, you can effectively buy that asset, or your super fund can buy the asset, and you can pay rent to yourself, which is better than paying rent to someone else. And so you have quite a lot of flexibility from that point of view. It's really about just making sure the documentation is done properly and the lender is satisfied to lend on the asset and you've got the deposit to put down in the first place.
And can you or a licensed advisor usually act as a bit of a one-stop shop in the sense that you would have a panel of lenders or go-to people to refer people to, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, I do. And I know you guys obviously have your associates as well. So yeah, I don't have any sort of hard and fast rule on who people should be going to, but I'll just say, look, you again use a well, usually a pretty experienced broker. And I actually help provide quite a bit of information for the broker to actually work from as well. So things like liquidity buffer, how much is in their bank account, all that sort of stuff, to make sure that the deal goes through.
Excellent. Are there any common misconceptions about investing your super in property that you come up against time and again?
I think one of the things would be people think it's too hard, it's too much paperwork, and I'll lose a big part of my life, doing all this admin stuff and everything like that. That's not really true. As I say, the initial paperwork and setup and that is fairly straightforward. There's a bit of it, but it's a one-off thing. And I basically do all that anyway. And people like me anyway will be the sounding board and making sure that everything's in order so that it's done properly, it's documented properly, it's signed properly, and we keep proper records and all of that. So the time spent is not as much as what people think, and it's not that complicated. Once you get the thing in place, it's really just about the establishment, and buying the property and getting the loan set up, and then I work on plans as to how we can reduce the debt more quickly by making higher pre-tax contributions, and obviously with the rent and so forth. So if you want to own the asset more quickly, I help people do all of that, and update the cash flow numbers every year or so, depending on how often it's required.
Fantastic. Well, you've certainly simplified it a lot for us, Andrew, and reduced the barriers to entry. If anyone wanted to go further, how would they make contact with you?
Yeah, I've got. I actually don't run a website because I've got a LinkedIn profile because all my business is word of mouth. So it's really just dropping me an email. They can call me on the mobile, but probably an email is best. And then what I try to do is to, I work to deadlines, but I need the clients to work to deadlines as well. So if they have a deadline to do something, they need to do that so I can keep my deadline. So it's really about proper communication, and if I'm sending information out, that they attend to that as soon as they can and get it back to me so that we can get things done in a timely manner. But they it's just an email to me, which I can send, I can give to you, and they can contact me accordingly.
Perfect. Is there
Yeah.
anything else that comes up or that listeners would want to know or ask about that you could think of?
I think the most powerful thing is the leveraging. You just can't leverage. It's the same with outside of property, outside of super. The issue, the reason people who've invested in residential over the last 30, 40 years, even when interest rates are much higher, you can't leverage 10 to 1, basically. People could borrow at 90% and or 85 or whatever the even at 80, you just can't leverage that impact. And if you get the asset growing at the rates, even at 4 or 5% a year, I'm not talking about 10%. It's on a much larger number. So as you're buying a property worth $600,000 and it goes up by 5% a year, and you've got your contributions, your rental income, and so forth, which you can then reduce debt more quickly. That the end benefit should be higher in the self-managed fund with that strategy. It's
Yeah.
obviously, as long as the asset goes up, of course, but that's the whole idea, using other people's money to create wealth. And in super, it can be even more beneficial because when you sell it down the track, if you're in retirement phase, then there's no tax on the capital gain.
Yeah, so tax benefits and also limitation of risk with the non-recourse lending.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing I should mention too, talking about risk, is that which the tax office talks about a bit as well, is that and I put this out in any advice I give, because I do a written report, statement of advice, in this sort of thing, so I cover all those things. But it's really about, so investment risk is, if you're buying a property, it's going to be concentrated in one asset initially, you know, and if you're able to acquire properties down the track, you'll be able to diversify more. And that's why the liquidity buffer is important to build that as well. So you've always got, you know, if it's 10 or 20 or 30% in shares and related investments like that, then you know, okay, the property asset's still the main asset, but I'm building this other diversified portfolio, which is liquid, which I can use to pay down debt if I want to down the track. So that is the only other thing that, and people understand that, but you know, you are investing in one asset, and hopefully it goes up over time.
Which property tends to do, very powerful asset class. And, there's no other asset class where you can get that massive benefit of leverage of moving than you can do leverage, I think, in shares and other things, can you? But not to the levels and the growth of property.
Well, the big issue is margin calls, and we saw that in the early 90s and also even the late 80s. Not that I've never done much in margin lending. I tend to get people to use home equity if they're going to borrow to buy shares, because there's no margin calls. So, you know, if the market does drop, you don't have to sell. You can actually buy more. And that's the advantage of property, that there's no margin calls. As long as you keep your payments up, you're not going to get a call.
Excellent. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time, Andrew. I know you're really busy and really grateful that you could make a window to talk to us. Really powerful stuff.
No worries, Don. And anytime, just let us know if there's any queries, and we'll put them in the right track.